Hi everyone. My name is Shreya and I am the director for the Localized History Project at the Asian American Asian Research Institute. We are so happy to have you all with us tonight as we celebrate and reflect and think through what Filipino American history means and what it means to celebrate and remember our history beyond the framework of a month, which is very limiting. For those of you who don't know, the Asian American Asian Research Institute is an institute at CUNY that researches and uplifts the stories and histories of the Asian American community of New York City. And then the Localized History Project more broadly is working with youth ages 16 to 22 throughout New York State to investigate to what extent Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander history is being taught in New York State public schools. But more importantly, what stories are missing and what stories we want uplifted through a localized history framework, which is a framework of history that just prioritizes community archives, youth voices, grassroots voices, and thinks through history through a lens that is less about covering all the history in the world and instead about uplifting the voices of the young people within our classrooms. And so I'm so excited to have with me two incredibly powerful forces, or I guess three and one incredibly powerful forces, who will be speaking to us today, about some of their work around Filipino history and through what I think is a comparably localized history framework, though not necessarily local to New York. And so we have Gabriela Sagan, and then we have the Filipino Curriculum Project here with us. I'm actually going to let them introduce themselves, because I think they can do so really powerfully. But what we're really excited to have a conversation about here today, is this idea of telling stories through resistance, uplifting community stories, and not just colonial archives or narratives about how a history should be taught. And then hopefully we will get a chance to think through what this can look like within our classroom spaces. And so, yeah, I'm really, really excited. I think Gabby will be going first. And so I will let her introduce herself, and then we can get into her presentation about Filipino American nurses, but also her own family history and ancestry and how that connects to the idea of the Filipino identity. So, yes, yeah, so let's please welcome and give a round of applause, for Gabriela Sagan.
Thank you for such a lovely introduction, Shreya. So hi everyone. My name is Gabriela Sagan. I use she/her pronouns. I'm a PhD student at Duke University in North Carolina. I am in the political science department and I specialize in security, peace, and conflict. My research specifically is about conflict-related violence against women in the Philippines. Before I was a student at Duke, I worked for 4 years in U.S. foreign policy on peace-building efforts in the Philippines. But most importantly, since like day one, I am Filipino American. My family's Kapampangan. I'm very proud, second-generation Filipino American. So I'm here to share some of the stories today that relate to my ancestry and how my family came to the United States, and I hope we'll also maybe feel related to some of how other people's stories about their migration. And before I get into my presentation, I do want to take the space to acknowledge that I am speaking to you today from the people of Bulumbi, in the United States, who still are not fully recognized by the U.S. Congress. I am very honored to come speak to you today, standing on their land that has been cared for and protected by them, as I share a story about migration and settler colonialism today. Before I get into like the meat and the fun, juicy parts of history, I want to really start this out by saying that I am not a historian by training. I might be a PhD student, but you are always potentially learning and teaching yourself history. And I'm not an expert in any of these histories by any means. But I know what it means to have your histories told and how it feels to share your histories with others. So my hope for this presentation is to really create a space where we can talk about some of these shared histories of migration and share each other's histories and stories today. So my presentation today is on U.S. Empire, Filipino nurses, and the gendered politics of care. So why Filipino nurses? So Filipino American nurses comprise 33% of all foreign-born registered nurses in the United States. There are 350,000 Filipino immigrants who are working in U.S. healthcare, and 143,000 of them are nurses. This is really significant in the context of the remittance economy of the Philippines, where 9% of the Philippines' GDP is from remittances, which are overseas cash transfers. And this comes to support over about a third of all households in the Philippines receive cash from abroad. So it's really important when we think about Filipino nurses working in the United States and working about overseas labor, this interconnectedness between the motherland and the United States and Filipino workers today. And then this kind of brings up a bigger question of like, why are there so many Filipino nurses in the United States? There are a huge amount of them. That's crazy. And the answer, like most things for most questions, is in colonialism. And I don't want to be too bogged down today in some of the like specific histories and treaties and dates, but I do want to sort of set the scene with why the United States ended up in the Philippines. So if we go back to 1823, President Monroe had his doctrine where he vowed that the United States would not interfere with other existing European colonies and that the United States would keep its backyard of Latin America and Europe should stay out and it won't interfere with any colonies whatsoever. Then 1893 rolls around, the United States had this huge economic crisis and the Monroe Doctrine isn't looking too fun right now. So the United States starts looking abroad for raw materials and export and import markets, including in colonial spaces and Spain. 1898, Spain sells the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam to the United States for $20 million, which comes out to about less than $3 per Filipino based on the population at the time. Filipinos did not take this lying down. There was a really significant history of incredible resistance and courage to fight American forces. There were 80,000 Filipinos who fought in the resistance forces. Only half of them had any types of like modern weapons and rifles. The other half were fighting with bolo knives or like machetes. And it should also be noted that during the occupation, there was a really brave contingent of Black American soldiers who were serving, who actually defected to join the Filipinos in the fight for resistance. So there's a really complicated history of how the Philippines has fought for its own independence under colonial occupation. And then 1900, President McKinley appoints William Howard Taft to be civil governor of the Philippines and gives him this commission to make Filipinos among the most civilized people of the world, which is some really fun language that we'll unpack a little bit. So that brings us to American nursing practices, where the McKinley Commission had this agenda to specifically transform the, quote, weak and feeble race of the Filipino to be strong and healthy. The underlying logic of this was that the United States would take over the administration of the Philippines until the Filipino was healthy and strong enough to do it themselves, but not quite yet, because the Americans have to take care of this first. So this sort of came from this knowledge and not this knowledge, this attitude and assumption that Filipinos were weak and were sickly. This came from, of course, the well-backed evidence of eugenicists who came to the Philippines and set up labs where they compared American bodies to Filipino bodies. And they constructed these false narratives and used pseudoscience to argue that Filipinos were carriers of pathogens and germs, and therefore you had to heal them. And the way to heal them was through American colonial projects of public health and nursing. So these nursing projects were spreading knowledge of Americanized Western medicine practices. I think it's really important to be nuanced here and to recognize that the spreading of access to healthcare is really important. Everyone should have access to healthcare, but to do so through this framework of like the white man's burden and to be enforcing often violently health practices onto others is doing so. It's like removing someone's agency. So there is a really complex narrative here. For example, there are stories of cholera victims who were forcefully administered their anti-cholera medications despite not wanting to without their consent. At the same time, a lot of medical practitioners were critiquing indigenous healers in their communities who had been taking care of their communities for generations. there's a really wonderful book that I think I'm just going to blur out that everyone should read called Empire of Care that is largely informed this presentation today. And in it, this incredible scholar talks about the conditions for migration of Filipino nurses under colonialism, including the professionalization of a nursing force under an American professional system. She talks about the specific use of English language instruction in all of these programs. To be a Filipino nurse who is trained in the United States system, you had to learn English. You had to also follow an American culture when it came to the nursing culture itself. Filipino-American nurses had to reside, or Filipino nurses working for the Americans had to reside on the hospital grounds, and they had to follow the same hierarchies that were expected of them in the workplace. There was a norm of families of young Filipinos having a household family that was very much mothered by the Americans. And then also really significantly is that there was a huge gendered component of Filipino nurses under U.S. colonialism. And there's a huge emphasis on this as a feminine tradition, and that if you were to be a nurse trained in the American tradition, you had to be an American feminine nurse. So that meant there were specific trainings in things like social graces. There was an expectation for understanding of, quote, home management, home economics. There was a specific emphasis on recruiting young women from reputable families in the Philippines. It wasn't just, you know, as equitable system where anyone could come in if they had the requirements or they met like the intellectual training. You had to come from a good family and really represent in the American perspective what a nurse should look like. And I think I'll touch about this gender perspective later on throughout the presentation, but this was a huge emphasis on the shaping and recruitment of women for U.S. Labor force. So this is kind of bringing me to a more nuanced aspect that I really want to talk about in this theme. So we have narratives here of Filipino nurses both being liberated and exploited through these projects. And I think that both narratives can be held true. And you will hear from individuals in their testimonies that they've shared experiences of feeling a lot of liberation. They got access to socioeconomic opportunities through nursing programs, but there also were many tales of exploitation and the racism that was endured during the nursing programs in the Philippines. Both are true. It's important to approach with nuance and also not decenter the agency of the individual nurses who are going through these experiences at the time. Most especially if they're your ancestors, you should not be undermining their agency when you tell their stories. So I want to touch on a few different aspects of this. So for example, I have this quote here from Apolonia Salvador Ladao, who was a nurse at the time in these programs, and she talked about how it was an exciting program for her and because she got to enter a new profession and serve her people. At the same time, there was widespread racial discrimination among the education cohort. American nursing instructors who were brought abroad to the Philippines were told that this would be like an exotic vacation to a tropical space, and then you would be educating the little brown women. It was the like kind of idea, and that led to a lot of racial discrimination in the workplace. American nurses often would disregard the nursing advices from their students. There was a norm of keeping Americans patients could only be seen by American nurses, despite all the Filipino nurses following the training of Americans. And there was a widespread patronizing attitude towards like the little men and the little women are not learning medicine. At the same time, there was very little compensation. This pay was on par of what nursing students in the United States would receive, but it still is very, very little compensation. It was about $8 to $12 per month. And these domestic worker and these Filipinos were expected not only to go through nursing programs, provide healthcare, but also they had to do significant domestic work to clean and take care of the hospital on top of all of this. At the same time, I think it's really important to note that this posed a huge pathway for socioeconomic mobility. A lot of women gained opportunity to education they wouldn't otherwise have. A lot of women gained access to independent income, which is really significant for women's safety and security. And as I'll talk later on about, this also created a huge pathway for migration if someone wanted to. Specifically through the Exchange Visitors Program, which was established in 1948 after the World War II. In the beginning, this program was set up to just facilitate the cultural exchange of different professions to the United States and largely from Western Europe. In the beginning, it was mainly nurses from Northern Europe to the United States. But by the 60s, 80% of these exchange participants were from the Philippines. And specifically, a lot of nurses were coming to the United States and constituted the first wave of mass migration of Filipinos abroad. There is also the construction of the Pensionado program, which basically through the visitors exchange program, you had this creation of an elite class of Filipino professionals who go study in the United States and then come back carrying their credentials and professional experience. So you had the emergence of new class divides coming out of this program as well. One student in particular described exchange visits as like a fun opportunity for sharing cultural ideas and meeting other medical students. At the same time, it's important to note, this was a really low salary. Being a student, a Filipino nursing student in the United States, the average salary for a Filipino nurse in 1971 in New York was 60,000 pesos per year, which at the time equated to about $9,600. At the same time, that salary was tremendous compared to what a Filipino nurse working in the Philippines would have made, which was about 4,600 pesos. So while there were huge, huge trade-offs and huge challenges to coming to the United States to serve as a nurse, it also should be noted that the growing socioeconomic gap between the Philippines and the United States motivated a huge outpouring of migration and nurses to come to the to come to the United States for socioeconomic support for their families. And this was so extreme that I think it was in 1960, but in the 1960s-ish period or 70s, there was the Philippine Nursing Association conducted a poll of prospective Philippine nursing students and asked, like, why do you want to be a nurse and pursue this study in this field? And 80% of them wanted to be a nurse specifically to migrate to the United States or another country. They wanted to go have the outside opportunity to bring funds back to their families and support them. However, in 1970, there was starting to be this shift as the Philippine economy was going through some tough times from this narration of cultural exchange between the United States and the Philippines to one of purely economic labor transfers. In 1970, a law was passed that made it a lot easier for these exchange visitors to adjust their visa status and become permanent residents more easily. At the same time, you saw this shifting narrative from cultural exchange to employment contracts and dollar repatriation systems to alleviate unemployment. The Philippines was in really, really bad situation with its economy. There was significant debt, significant deficit was being run. And then to top it all off, in 1972, Marcos announced martial law. Later, Marcos, in an effort to try to save his economy, makes this huge address where he emphasizes that you should be promoting the migration of nurses specifically for money for the Philippines. There was a commodification of Filipino nurses through the mass production in this U.S. colonial trading system for an international market. Marcos wanted to promote foreign currency accumulation from workers abroad to strengthen the Philippine economy. So we are explicitly using Filipino women's labor to fund and fix Marcos's maybe not most Marcos' mistakes, but legacies of mistakes in the Philippines. Also, it would have been a lot easier if the Marcos family hadn't stolen billions of dollars from the Filipino people. But that's a different story. And I also want to note that around this time, the 1980s, you start to see the creation of balik bayan boxes, where Filipino Americans start sending goods back to the Philippines because Filipino Americans are enjoying comparably more disposable income, benefiting from the socioeconomic mobility offered by these nursing programs and the migration pathways. And now I want to kind of take a more sentimental note and share my personal history of why this history means so much to me is because my family came to the United States because of these visitors exchange programs. My Lola, Clarita Sarmiento Sagan, she was doing the visitor exchange program and she came to Chicago for 2 years. When she got home, 6 months later, she married my grandfather. They were deeply, deeply in love. And then they filed as quickly as they could to migrate to the United States. And in 1969, they migrated to the United States with my father and my uncle. Part of why they migrated was because my Lola had this huge fear of the rising tensions under the Marcos administration. And she was afraid of what it would mean to raise children under martial law. And unfortunately, she was really smart and she was right. In 1972, martial law was passed and caused a lot of conflict and chaos in the country. And we're still dealing with the effects of martial law in the Marcos administration today. So what does this mean for Filipino American nurses today? What are some of the challenges they face? Well, I think it's really important to note that because Filipino American nurses faced a disproportionate number of deaths related to COVID, they were 5% of the nursing labor force in 2020, but they made up 30% of COVID-related deaths among healthcare workers. There's also this emergent Filipino American health paradox, where Filipinos compromise a huge amount of the healthcare labor force, but experience significant health disparities among Asian Americans. One scholar from Berkeley talks about how Filipinos are like the major providers of healthcare services, but they're burdened by significant chronic health inequalities themselves. And I want to tie this back to the sort of founding narratives of the U.S. nursing programs with Filipinos and how Filipinos came to be here in the United States. We had this extension of American gendering of nursing as feminine labor. There's a construction of a women's sphere of labor as the imposition of American gender norms to uplift the Filipino race into modernity. There's an amazing scholar named Prenhas who does an analysis of Filipino domestic workers and talks about how there's this framework of care to ensure the reproduction of the family. Means that we are looking at the vital role of Filipino domestic workers coming overseas and taking on the labor of motherhood and caretaking for the American family. And if we extend this idea of taking care of the American family as a Filipino labor and think about the nation, the United States, as an extension of the American family, we are seeing that Filipino nurses are serving the reproduction of the family through material care and the protection of health of the nation. The United States has used its colonial project to train and import labor to sustain the health of the United States. Filipino nurses are sustaining the health of the United States while enduring these significant health disparities. So as much as this history started with this narrative of the white man saving the Filipino, ultimately Filipino American labor, Filipina women's labor has been used to care for Americans and to save the white man. So with that, I'm going to conclude the bulk of my presentation. I would be remiss not to talk about my two important resources, which are, number one, these are some really fabulous books. If anyone wants copies or free downloads of them, I will gladly share them with you. Empire of Care largely informed a lot of the analysis and the quotes I used today. I would also love to share any of the other works that broadly speak to U.S. colonialism and nursing. And then most importantly, I want to talk about one of the most important resources for history, which is your elders. You should talk to your elders and hear their stories. I called my Lolo today to hear all these stories about my Lola. These are two of my Lolos down at the bottom at the airport having a great time. And, you know, go to your ancestral homeland. Like, these are pictures from Pampanga. This is my ancestral homeland in Balubad. Like, go talk to the people in your community. If you don't have grandparents around, you know, there are elders in your community who are looking out for you. They know so much. I think it's really important that when we talk about these histories, you know, we see facts and written as like dates and times. And I know I had a whole outline of like timelines, but that's not really like what actual history meant for like the human experience, talking to individual people. So you need to go talk to your elders and listen to them. And that is a way of caretaking for your elders as well, as to write down their stories and honor them. Like, I have all of these notebooks where I've written down stories that my grandparents have told me. And that is really important history. So I want to take the moment to just tell everyone here that you do not need to be a quote, like, professional historian to learn your own history. And you can learn your own history through your family. And that is a really powerful way to provide testimony to the labor of your ancestors. So I will stop there, and thank you everyone for your time.
Wow. That was absolutely incredible. Thank you so much, Gabriella. And also, I think so many of the threads that you wove were just so beautiful, and I really love the like ending of like the Filipino Save the White Man. I think that was fantastic. We're now going to turn it over to the Filipino Curriculum Project, which is an absolutely incredible story, but also resource that I'm so excited to hear from and to share with all of you. We have three members of the original student advocacy team with us. all of whom grew up in Hawaii, but who some of whom are in different parts of the country at this point. And so I will turn it over to them to introduce themselves and to share their project with you. And after their presentation, we'll have an opportunity to maybe take a look at some sample lessons from the curriculum project, but then also open it up to conversations from the audience for both Gabriella and for the curriculum project. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Marissa, Mariah, and Bricks. Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. Can you guys hear me well? Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for having us here today. Such an honor. And thank you, Gabriella, for sharing your research about Filipino nurse. We're all like taking notes and sharing our notes with each other earlier, but we really appreciated how you highlight how colonial projects like really seep through every aspect of our life, including health and education, which is what our segment is all about. And thank you, Shreya, for bringing us all together. Engaging in these critical conversations, especially during Filipino American History Month, which is this month. And so actually, this year's theme for FOM, which is Filipino American History Month, is struggle, resistance, solidarity, and resilience. And I think that like this workshop alone definitely embodies those values as we stand here today, as Filipino Americans sharing our narratives, despite the impacts of colonialism and imperialism in our livelihoods. And so we're going to go ahead and start with our presentation. We're going to be sharing about what FCP is. And then we're kind of going to go over like how the process was in terms of curriculum development and just share our experiences through it all. So this is our website. I know like we only have 30 minutes and there's so much stuff to cover. So we'd love for you to check out our website. We'll share the link on the chat.
Thank you so much, Mariah, for starting us off. Hi, everyone. My name is Marissa. And like Mariah said, we are a group of Filipino students from Hawaii. And our goal for the past 3 years has been to really utilize our student voice to advocate for representation in the curriculum that we're learning, right? Because representation is so important. And so before we kind of share a little bit more about who we are, our journey and our progress, we really wanted to ask you all this opening question. So I really want everyone to reflect on a time where you felt represented in the curriculum that you were learning or in any sort of educational space. And then also how did that make you feel? So you can use like verbs like you felt like you were empowered, you felt like you were able to connect with the curriculum possibly, or it could have also been like an experience where you wanted more of that, right? Maybe it was like a small like representation and you wanted to dig deeper, right? So there's many different ways you can answer this question, but I think so many of us have had these instances where we will go through so many times, or we would go through so many years of school without ever learning about or cultivating our identities. But then when we do feel represented, when we do like learn about, for example, like Filipinos in a history curriculum, we feel very much seen, right? So we really wanted to bring us into that sort of mindset of remembering like the importance of representation, because that is really what our project is about. So in an ideal world, I would have everyone share, you know, their reflections on this, but just, it would be great if everyone could keep this in mind as we move through the presentation, because as of the Filipino Curriculum Project, we see you and we hear you when we say that as students, we rarely do get this positive representation, and we need to continue striving for more critically conscious, holistic, culturally competent types of curriculum. So yeah, something to think about. So just a little bit of a background of who we are. So we are the Filipino Curriculum Project, and we are a group of students that created this initiative from Hawaii. And we came together in the spring of 2021 to collaborate on developing a curriculum focused on Filipino history, culture, and identity. Something that you may not know is that Filipinos are actually the largest Asian ethnic group in Hawaii. And that really stems from, you know, a very rich but also painful history of labor, of resistance, of solidarity. When the Philippines was colonized by the United States, there were a lot of Filipino workers that were coerced into coming to Hawaii to work in the sugar plantations. So our community has had long roots in Hawaii, but we never learn about that in the curriculum that we're learning. So this curriculum that we really wanted to create aims to bring more Filipino representation to Hawaii schools. And we're really excited to announce that the course that we created in collaboration with educators called Filipino History and Culture is now available in Hawaii Department of Education schools. So this has taken a couple years to achieve, but it is all something that has been very student-centered. So me, Mariah, and Rix are happy to share with you about our journey today.
Sorry, I know I'm not so supposed to interrupt, but I feel like we just need to take a second to reflect on how absolutely like bonkers incredible it is that a group of young people were able to not only do this work of building a history curriculum, but actually get it implemented within their schools within a timeline that I think is unfathomable to most adults. And so I just want to like pause for a moment and just be like, that's absolutely incredible. And you guys are so cool. Okay, sorry. Please continue.
No, thank you so much, Shreya, for saying this. And I hope a takeaway for that is that you guys all, or us all as students, have so much power in our voices, right? Like, we should be and are and can be the architects of our own education. And so I really want everyone to, like, something, like, if you take one thing away from this, is that you really can make a difference in the spaces that you occupy. And we really hope that this can be, like, an inspiration to you all. And yeah, we're really excited to be here to share. But yeah, I'll turn it back over to Mariah to kind of share a little bit more about our student team.
I think that was a perfect segue, because this graphic alone shows that more people are joining the initiative, and there's just this growing movement of ensuring representation within the curriculum. And so actually the slides presentation we had yesterday had like our old statistics graphic, and then instead of 58 student collaborators, it was 29. And so just seeing like the growth today is really amazing. And so again, like, this project is very student driven, student initiative. We started off with 5 members initially. Now we have 58 collaborators, and each of the collaborators has something to bring in the table. Like, when you talk about identities, we have folks that are immigrants, folks that grew up in Hawaii, and people that grew up from across the nation. And so we're in this project together, bringing in all our experiences and knowledge as a manifestation of the curriculum now. And so this is definitely like a whole community that we form within the curriculum project, and hopefully that's something that's like manifested as people take the course. But bottom line, more students joined the project wanting to make a difference within their communities. And in the next slide is just a graphic that kind of shows how students are from different schools. So Brix, if you could go on to the next slide. Yeah, so we have a lot of students from across the island. Predominantly right now, it's like mainly people from Oahu. We're trying to get more people from different islands, but there's definitely a representation of students from a wide variety of schools, whether it be public, private, charter schools.
And this here is the graphic describing the statistics and demographics of our inaugural teacher cohort. As was mentioned before, the course is starting to be offered in schools this semester. And even though it's only in 2 schools so far, this is the summary of the data from all of the schools. So there's 11 public schools. And these are all the teachers that participated in the professional development. So not all of these schools are implementing CHR 2300, which is our course in it, but they implement many different parts of our curriculum, and you can just see how diverse this cohort is. This is just a slide describing like who we are, but And if we didn't introduce ourselves yet, my name is Brix Kazuki. I'm born and raised here in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I'm a first year at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I'm double majoring in political science with a concentration of international relations and also Chinese language.
Right. Or Marissa, you can start off, but maybe in this slide we could share like 1 to 2 minutes of why we like joined the project
Our
because
why?
our why. Because like every time we give our
Okay.
presentations, like we ground it with the reason why we're here, because identity is a central part of the curriculum. So Marissa or Briggs, you could start off.
Okay, Marissa, since you're the founder, why don't you say your why, introduce yourself?
Okay, sure. Yeah, we just want to introduce ourselves, but also, like Mariah said, explain a little bit why we're here and why this project means so much to us. So hi everyone, my name is Marissa Haligao. I'm the founder of the Filipino Curriculum Project. So I actually founded this project when I was a sophomore in high school, and now I'm a sophomore in college. I currently attend Yale University, and I'm studying ethnicity, race, and migration and education studies. And I think that really encapsulates how much this project has informed my like internal and cultural and leadership development and my love for and passion for ethnic studies and the power of education. So yeah, I'm studying like ethnic studies and education in school, but then I'm able to actually apply that and contribute that to the movement that we've been working on for the past few years back home in Hawaii. So yeah. Me and Briggs actually went to the same high school. And I say that because my story really starts at that school because the reason why I wanted to start this project, or at least start bringing more Filipino representation of curriculum, is because when I was a sophomore in high school, I was taking an Asian history class. And because there are a lot of Asian Americans in Hawaii, that class really was meant to kind of represent the fact that there were a lot of Asians, but however, Filipinos were not included in that curriculum. And so me as a Filipino student sitting in that classroom reading that syllabus and realizing that the Philippines was not included made me feel disappointed, one, but it also made me feel really unseen, right? I didn't feel represented in the curriculum that I was learning. I was really excited to learn about Filipino history, but I felt like my history was actually not worthy to be studied because that's what the curriculum communicated to me. And so that was when I got in touch with the teachers at my school and asked if I could help be in charge of writing just a Filipino history unit or a new Asian studies course. And so that was actually a really successful project. The teachers at my school were really supportive. And the next year, our high school implemented Asian studies. And so that was when students were able to learn about so much more than just China and Japan. That's actually something I meant to mention, that the original Asian history course was very East Asian centric and only focused on Chinese and Japanese history. But this new course was actually one that was very theme and conceptual based. And that was something that I also gave feedback. As a student, I really wanted like students and peer and my peers to be able to learn about these histories and connect them with each other, understand historical impacts, do much more than just a timeline and memorization, but also looking to like place-based history too. And it just so happened that a student in that class was Briggs. So Briggs is a year younger than me, so I was able to go to that class and teach some of the lesson plans that I created for that Filipino history unit. And so after that, I founded the Filipino Curriculum Project with our original 5 members. And that was really the first time students from different schools were able to connect with each other to work on a project relating to Filipino history. And so the project was formed because a lot of us had similar experiences of being in a classroom, realizing that we're not learning about our Filipino identity, or maybe that was just something that was internalized, that was something that was normalized. And so that was when we came together, students, and we said, look, we can create a Filipino history culture class for ourselves so that students and the next generation will never have to question that like how we did. And so that was how the Filipino Curriculum Project was formed. And pretty soon, like, students from so many other schools really wanted to join. And it really has become such a community of empowerment as students. Like, I've learned so much about my history and culture and my community even being in this project and helping lead it. So yeah, that's a little bit why I started the project, but also why it's really important to me. Because we know representation is so powerful, but critical and empowering representation, that's what matters. So yeah, thank you for letting me share that, but I'll turn it over to Mariah and Bricks to also share their story as well, because we do want to highlight that identity piece that is so prevalent in our curriculum.
Thank you, Marissa, for sharing it. We're just bringing the whole SCP together. Like, we really appreciate you, and we're proud of, like, the progress you've made, even with your initiative at Yale, which I hope you'll get to talk about towards then. But my name is Mariah. I'm a current sophomore at Barnard, and I'm currently studying political science and educational studies. I used to be ERM, but I just, like, it's so sad because, like, it's hard to get an Asian American studies class here in college. Like, you'd expect, like, you'd have more opportunities, but that just is evident that we still have a long way to go in ensuring that we do have these curriculum available to all students. But aside from those identities, one thing that's very important to me is being an immigrant, because being an immigrant is a symbolism of a lot of resiliency. But I've never really felt proud to be an immigrant growing up. So I was, like, raised in Hawaii. And as we mentioned in the beginning, Hawaii is predominantly, like, Filipino population. But for some reason, like, I just did not feel like I belong in a space where people look like me and talk like me. And I never really, like, understood why until now. And so as I took the time to reflect, I think I kind of attribute it to this concept called crab mentality. Like, I don't know if you guys heard of that before, but if you haven't, crab mentality is basically an attitude where you, like, drag people down instead of empowering each other. And I guess, like, being an immigrant being an immigrant at a later age, I was kind of seen by family members a little less. And in schools, like, I was flagged as an EL student, and some of that wasn't capable of accomplishing much. And so this immigration identity kind of disempowered me to, like, be a part of the Filipino community. Like, I just did not feel comfortable saying that I was Filipino. But I'm really grateful to be a part of this curriculum, because being in conversation and just being in community with Marissa Bricks and the rest of my peers, as well as scholars we've met along the way, and just the wider community in general, like, I've learned to embrace that identity a little bit more now. And I'm really appreciative that I've been able to learn more about my history as well, because trap mentality and colonialism and embracing whiteness is intrinsically linked to each other. And so now, like, I'm proud to say that I am an immigrant and that I am Filipino. Through this course, I hope that others also feel the same way. But that's a little bit about my story, and I'll pass it on to Bricks.
Hi, guys. I already introduced myself a little bit before, but yes, my name is Bricks. And my story about the Filipino Curriculum Project also reaches deep back into my childhood. I'm actually half Filipino. Some of you might think I don't look full Filipino. Well, it's because I'm half. My mom is from Quezon City, but our family has roots from north to south in the Philippines. And my father is actually from here in Hawaii, and he's half Japanese and half Chinese. And family's been here for generations. Sugar plantation, pineapple plantation stories. Yeah, that's a whole other story. But growing up, I didn't grow up in a predominantly Filipino neighborhood. And I wasn't really that exposed to Filipino and culture outside of the one that my mom gave me, which wasn't that much, but it was enough to, like, kind of give me an appreciation for my culture. But when I was growing up, I did experience many like microaggressions, like ethnic jokes. Ethnic jokes are really prevalent in Hawaii, and while they do kind of help to bring the different communities in Hawaii together, like in sort of a morbid sense actually, but it also can create stereotypes and unsaid divisions, which is unhealthy for a community. But in 7th grade, we were all asked to write a speech in class, and I did mine about how Filipinos were underrepresented in our media or represented incorrectly. And I found it shocking that Filipinos made up no less than 25% of Hawaii's population and are the largest Asian ethnic group in Hawaii. And so I had that in the back of my mind for a few years, but then in my freshman year of high school, I found out about Filipino Curriculum Project, which my ate, Marissa, founded, and I started to get involved with it. And as of now, it's been about a year and a half since I've joined the Filipino Curriculum Project. And learning about the history of Filipinos in Hawaii has really compelled me to be a part of the long lineage of people working towards the improvement of the Filipinos in Hawaii, the United States, and back in the Philippines. And I'm so honored to be part of that. And I'll have us move on now to our next slide, which is Marissa.
Thank you so much, Bricks, for sharing. So now we're going to get more into our journey. This is a really, really quick snapshot of our progress. So basically, we did start with the collaboration of students coming together, realizing that there's a problem and recognizing that we can do something about it, right? So the problem was that even though there is this really long and rich history of Filipinos being in Hawaii, we never learn about that in the curriculum in our schools. So we got together, we collaborated, and then we reached out to teachers to help us create a curriculum about Filipino history and culture and identity. And through a lot of advocacy efforts, through presenting with our principals, our teachers, our administrators, and then eventually with the superintendent and working with legislators in the Hawaii State Congress, we eventually got our course approved to be taught in all Hawaii Department of Education schools. So yes, that was the course approval. And then we will move on to school implementation. So something that I really want to highlight is that even though our course is approved, wait, I'm so sorry, Brooks, can you go back really quickly? Even though our course is approved for all schools, it is not implemented in all of them because that is another journey in and of itself, right? You need the teachers to teach it, the schools need the resources, and you also need the demand of students. So to solve the first requirement of you need teachers to teach it, we actually helped create a professional development program where teachers were trained to teach this. So this was entirely like spearheaded by the educators that we collaborated with. But students, like as ourselves, we still played a hand in how we really wanted the professional development to look like. We helped look over like the lesson plans that we created and how that's going to be taught to teachers so they can teach it. And we were still really involved in that process. And then now we have the mobilization aspect, which is what we're in right now. So like Mariah said, we grew from originally 5 members of our team to 29 and now to 58, almost 60. And that's because we've incorporated so many other students from schools from across Hawaii so that there are students working within each school to advocate for the course to be taught at their school. Because, like we said, student voice is so, so important in actualizing change. So we're really in the mobilization aspect right now. And now we're so excited to announce that 6 more schools have pledged to offer the course. So we're really moving forward towards more implementation of the curriculum. Next slide,
And
please.
sorry, in the interest of time, we decided to not go really into detail, but we're happy to share these slides with everybody
Oh, okay,
afterwards.
yes. Guys, we're so sorry.
Yes.
We love to yap. We love talking about this project because it
For
means so
real.
much to us. But okay, basically, okay. This is basically just going more in depth into that journey, but that was like more of a snapshot. This is where we were recruiting more students to join the team, so helping to advocate for and mobilizing so that this is implemented at their school.
I was going to say, guys, you have 15 minutes. like you can take 15 more minutes. We'll start questions at like 7:45. So don't stress about
time.
Okay. okay.
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this is
just a picture from our professional development one of our sessions that we had. Yeah.
So this is us with all the teachers.
Wait, can you go back to the teacher slide? Sorry, I just wanted to mention one thing. I think like it was such a meta moment, I think at least for me when it comes to working this project, because being in school, you're always used to that teacher being up like in the front and them just like spitting out facts to you, like students, you're the ones retaining that information. But through this project in of itself, like I think we were able to break those barriers and those like dichotomy to what it means to be an educator and what it means to be a student, because this project really allowed us to work hand in hand with each other. And so like what Marissa mentioned, like with the student collaborators, you're in charge of creating the lesson plans, especially like lessons that we wish we learned growing up, because this is for us, for students anyways. And then with the educator design team, they were there to help refine the lesson plans throughout the whole process, but also like valuing our input in every stage. And so like working alongside educators was definitely a meta moment, because it showed that we all could come together to create the curriculum we wished we had growing up. But just wanted to like throw that out there, because I know like a lot of the youth in this panel is also creating a curriculum, and I hope that you could utilize your community members, educators around you, as a resource to create something that you wish you had growing up. And then these are...
Sorry, we have so many pictures.
It's okay. Do you want to talk about the Summer Leadership Conference?
Sure. So this is, I don't know, you guys saw the flyer back there of Please Join the Filipino Curriculum Project. And so we wanted to introduce a lot more collaborators into our project, which we did. Also, here's a lesson. When you introduce new people into your project, make sure you have an intention and have a goal that you want to set for the number of people you want to add. But now we have 58 student collaborators, which is great. We have a lot of hands to work on. And this is just one of the activities that we have to help them all integrate it into the project. And it's a student orientation or conference. And we just had them do a crash course on FCP and did some fun activities. So, yeah.
Yeah, can I actually, sorry.
And so, yes.
So that as well. Thank you, Bricks, for saying that. Something that I really wanted to emphasize here is that this was like a prime example of students teaching students. So me, Mariah, Bricks, and many of like the current student collaborators, we were able to, you know, design this orientation program this summer, where we got to welcome new peers and also facilitate a lot of dialogue and like cultural understanding, and also talk about what it means to be Filipino, what it also means to be a student, what it means to be a student advocate. And this was honestly like I helped lead this orientation, and the whole goal was to help empower students and help you know, introduce them to the project, help give them the tools to advocate in their school. But it was also such an empowering moment and experience for me as well, because I was able to, you know, use what I've learned as a leader to help make a difference in my peers' lives, but also try to help uplift their voices and their experiences too, in within a system that never, you know, prioritizes that. And it was actually so heartwarming to hear all of, you know, everyone's thoughts, everyone's reflections, and talking about how this like orientation was so meaningful and life-changing for them, because they've never been in a space of like all Filipino students where they were empowered to, you know, make a difference in their schools, form community and bonds with each other, reflect on what being Filipino means, and also talking about the long-standing history of Filipinos, and specifically Filipino youth,
fighting in resistance and then resilience against structures that were never meant to be there for us and our well-being and our identity. So this was like such a very big pivotal moment this summer. And it's really exciting that we have so many students who are so excited, so motivated. And it's really so heartwarming for me, especially to see like the growth of FCP. Because we, like we said, we started off with 5 members. This was really just like, it came through like 1 Zoom call when we were like, oh, like maybe we should like, you know, create a curriculum. And then fast forward to now, there's so many of us that are passionate about this. So yeah, I just wanted to add that.
So now we have a preview of the content that we have in our Filipino History and Culture course. So these are the 6 major units which are included in the course. So the first one is identity. So starting with the basics, what makes you you? And in that, we explore all aspects of identity and make sure that the student really starts to build a foundation for themselves on who they are and what makes you, you. And for the second one, we have historical interactions and the development, and that just goes over the development of the Philippines and historic interactions. And the third one is culture and connection. So it really emphasizes the culture and connections. And the fourth one is really interesting because it delves into the history of Filipinos in Hawaii and the United States. So we introduce topics like the Sakadas, which are the plantation workers that came to Hawaii to work on the sugarcane and pineapple fields, about the nurses that Gabriela talked about, and many other aspects about the deep, the dark, the bright, the amazing history of the Philippines and the United States. And for number 5 is the Philippines in an interconnected world. So that's harking back to the times that we're in now and analyzing how the Philippines and Filipinos are interacting with the world in this rapidly globalization world. And number 6 is community engagement and civic action. So what action can students of the course take to make their voices heard to help our community become better? And so this is the identity, what makes you you. And so this is an inquiry design model, also known as IDM. And so this is the blueprint of how lesson plans are formed in the course. And so as you can see, there's a lot of different details in it, but this is the framework that we decided to use. It really gives the teachers flexibility, and because it's such a course that makes you analyze who you are personally, this also allows the teachers to implement how they would like to teach the course while still building upon the framework that we have for them. And so teachers are able to present their own opportunities, their own background, their own point of view, and also to allow the students more flexibility in it too, rather than making everybody teach the exact same things. We're still teaching the same concepts, but in different ways for each teacher in class. And so one of the activities that, one of the examples in this IDM is to have students listen to the song Us by Ruby Ibarra. You can keep the QR code for later, and we'll try to share these slides with you later, but the song is very eye-opening and ear-opening, and it's just a great song all around. And so we have this question for the students and for you. You just think about this too. So what is your entrance song? What 5 songs would you include in a Who Am I playlist? And remember that this is in Unit 1, Identity. Who am I? So really think about that. We tell the students and including in your playlist. And now we have an update on FCP right now from Marissa.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brooks, for sharing. So just to close off, I really want to look ahead and what this means for Filipinx studies and representation as a whole. We really hope that this curriculum and this project really inspires and kind of helps, you know, set the precedent for much more work in like Filipino liberating pedagogies. So yeah, I mean, as of right now, we're still continuing to meet as a group. We're giving updates about our school. It's really exciting. We have a lot of community engagement projects happening because right now in Hawaii, FCP is something that is, or a lot of people in the community know about. We have a lot of community support. So we're really helping, you know, commemorate or trying to commemorate a lot of the Filipino history in Hawaii in community engagement events. And we really want to continue to help share our story and use the tools and knowledge and identity making that we cultivated within this project and apply it to other projects as well. So something that like I would like to share that I kind of did that similar to that is help spearhead the student advocacy initiative in getting Tagalog language courses here at Yale. So when I was a first year last year, I came to Yale to college, first time living away from home, and I really did miss the Filipino community that I had you know, been so a part of the last few years at home. And I was disappointed that there were no Filipino language courses here, even though Tagalog is the fourth most spoken language in the US. And so I saw direct parallels between that and the principle in which we founded and worked on the Filipino curriculum project back home in Hawaii, right? Because Filipinos are the largest Asian ethnic group in Hawaii, but why is our history not being told in our curriculum? And similar to that, why is Tagalog the fourth most spoken language in the country, but a very elite privileged institution that has a lot of power, such as Yale, not offered that? And so I was actually able to, you know, find my Filipino community here on campus. And so many of us also felt the same way, right? Like, why is our language, why is our identity not represented in the curriculum at this school? And so very similar to FCP, it was a very big community effort. We rallied together. We petitioned the school. We got a lot of community support from peers, from the wider community. We like passed a bill through the student body senate. We met with a lot of, you know, administrators and teachers. And eventually, we are really excited to announce that Tagalog, because of our student advocacy efforts, will be offered as a language next year in 2025. So this is just a direct example of FCP really influencing the work that I do today. But I really, really hope that you know, the things that we've done in the student movement is able to kind of inform, inspire, and also support and be in solidarity with numerous other student movements. We know that we are definitely not the only Filipino youth fighting for empowerment, for liberation, and so many of our initiatives are intertwined. So yeah, that's something that a story that we kind of wanted to close off. Brix, if you can move to the next slide, are just some quotes from many other students in the curriculum project. We really wanted to highlight their words as well. But it's just always so uplifting to kind of ground ourselves and recognize why this is so important to us as students in finding ourselves, right? In finding our culture, being able to share that with others, and you know, using our student voices to make a difference. So we are really thankful for this opportunity to share our story with you all. We are open to any questions. We would love to help with the initiatives and efforts that you are all doing, because as students, we should all support each other. So yes, thank you so much for giving us this space, and it is lovely being in community with you all. So thank you, Maramik Slama.
Thank you all so much. I want to give another round of applause to both of our presenters, and especially the Filipino Curriculum Project for their presentation just now. That was absolutely incredible. And both of these presentations were so inspiring and so elucidating of the ways that sharing these stories really matters, sharing not just family stories, but localized histories, and building these kinds of grassroots archives of what history can look like, I think is so powerful. So we do want to open it up to questions. And so I would invite folks, I think, I see Chelsea has already modeled how to use the raise hand feature. So if folks want to use the raise hand feature, that's great. If you want to send me a question to read for you, I'm happy to do so as well. We do have a few questions that had come through in the chat, so I want to honor those first, and then I'll go over to Chelsea, and then we can keep going around. So just scrolling. Okay, so the first question that we have is for Gabriella. This is from Yuan. They're asking, how did the interviews go with your family members? How did you structure your questions? I think this is in reference to you said you called up your Lolo and were asking him questions about your history. But I'm actually going to expand that history because a lot of our students are planning on doing oral storytelling interviews with their elders. And so what advice do you have for students, not just in terms of interviews and structuring questions, but just seeking out elders and collecting their stories?
Oh, those are such good questions. Well, also, thank you for the opportunity to talk about my Lolo, which is my favorite thing ever. So I'm very lucky. I have a very close relationship with my Lolo, so I love talking about her personal history and asking him questions. But I think he's someone who's very quiet, and I'll ask him a question about, like, oh, tell me about, like, you know, what it was like when Lola migrated to the U.S. and, like, her experience in these programs. He'll say, oh, I don't know, Gabriella. And then he'll launch into, like, 30 different stories at once, and you have to write really fast to keep up with it. So I would say that, you know, just like every Filipino elder is a little bit different, but I would also say I feel like a key theme that I've experienced when I've asked the elders about their stories is they will just start wherever they want to start, and you just have to just be along for the ride and be present with them. I would also say it's important if you are bringing up a topic that gets heavy, like for us, talking about our Lola can be really emotional because she passed away many years ago. So I think sitting, not just asking a question and leaving, but like sitting with the emotions that those memories bring up is really important, and documenting that as well. I think also just in general, like being conscious of like the space you're running into, and thinking to yourself, like, why do I really want to know the answers to these questions? I think a lot of times in other disciplines, when it comes to interviews and research, sometimes the interviews can be kind of exploitative or, you know, messy when it comes to the ethics of why someone wants to learn someone's personal stories. But I think as long as you know, like, your objective and your driving question for why you care about these personal histories, I think that'll come through in the way that you ask questions. And then as far as asking questions to elders, I would say that, you know, if you show an interest and you just let them open up on their own time, that can be really wonderful. I had an interview over the summer with a community elder when I did field work in the Philippines, and she started out by telling me all about her medical issues, and it took a long tale of talking about all of her personal medical issues to get to questions of patriarchy, but we got there in the end. So I'd also say please honor your elder space, because if they have something they're going to tell you, they will get to it, but it might take a minute. So I'll stop there.
Amazing. I think that point about time is a really huge one, is like sometimes sitting in very awkward silence for a very long time until they decide to share a story, or the alternative of sitting through a lot of stories and navigating through those stories is also important. And sometimes it's not about the story you want to hear, but the story that the elder wants to share, and really capturing that with authenticity, I think can be one of the powers that oral storytelling has, is that it's not a research methodology. It comes from indigenous ways of knowing and being that all of these, you know, predominantly non-Western cultures hold. And so it's also honoring the fact that storytelling was not for research. Storytelling is for community. And so how does that shift the process? Okay, we have a question for the Filipino Curriculum Project. This is from John. John is a Filipino-American living in New York City. And so he asks, knowing that this project is primarily based in Hawaii and in many ways aim to serve Filipino American communities in Hawaii, in what ways can interested students from other states contribute? Thank you.
Anybody that's interested in our project can, of course, follow our Instagram or look at our website. But like, if you want to email us, like if you're interested in starting something of your own, we can definitely help you with that. I think our framework can easily be applied to any locale across the United States or the world even, just and drawing upon like our story, I think like if we did it, then you guys can do it too probably. But just find those around you that are willing to support you and find other students so you can amplify your voice. And I don't know if Marissa or Mariah had anything to add on that.
I do want to echo what Brick said. This should be a curriculum that is transferable to so many other places. This is not just exclusive to Hawaii. We do have like a really big like place-based learning aspect, but that should mean that the curriculum can be adopted to the place that it's in as well. So actually, if you look at our website or if you like go on our social media pages, we really want to make sure that our curriculum and a lot of the material is accessible to people, because curriculum should be something that is like accessible to all. We even shared like our slides in the chat, but we really hope that we can continue to build partnerships with people not from Hawaii as well, because I know like a curriculum like this is so needed in so many other different places. So yeah, thank you so much for that question.
Yes, and I'm not really sure if the question was asked to like how can people from outside of Hawaii support the Filipino Film Project here, but like if that was the question, like do follow our Instagram, do look at our website, but we do also have a GoFundMe, yeah, that we use to fund our activities, and it is running out, so thank you.
Sorry, I'd like to add one quick thing. I know we're short on time, but I think like FCP has more, like it's more than just like a course now. I think like it also gains a lot of like international traction. So we gotten a lot of emails from educators in the Philippines sharing their resources. So in some way, like FCP has become this repository of like knowledge, literature, and just like this repository of like so many Filipino related things. That it's part of this larger movement now of sharing Filipino history. So I just wanted to emphasize that I think like it's beyond just a course. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, I do want to honor, I think Chelsea had a question, and then Clarissa I just saw has a question.
Sweet, thank you. Hey everyone. So first of all, I just want to shout out to Gabriella. She is part of our team here at Phil Excellence, and wanted to make sure that I highlighted the fact that we are so happy and so honored and proud to have her on our team. And her presentation today kind of summarizes that as to why. Also for FCP, I really want to highlight as well, because I messaged Bricks in the chat, but also I am a University of Hawaii grad. And I can echo a lot of the sentiments that you guys said that you felt, not necessarily growing up because I'm not Kumaina, but really, I think people don't. There's this like mask, that Tony De La Rosa talks about how the fact that there's so much presence of the Kababayan in Hawaii that people assume that there's no racism, there's no nothing that happens in Hawaii when it's actually the complete opposite. So I kind of wish at times that I had something like this to kind of fall back on, because like it was a weird experience coming from California, which is also another highly Filipino populated state, coming to Hawaii and almost feeling like more of the racism existing. And I think it's because of the nuances that you guys highlight. So I just really want to thank you guys for the work that you're doing, but also to ask if when this program in my mind looks really it is like quintessentially a direct action program, which is what I love, is that you are setting it up so that local chapters or entities can customize it and have it, and there's no barriers to the access of success essentially for it. I guess like the larger question I'm trying to ask is, how do you see this going? Like once you all graduate from your programs, well, what kind of involvement do you see this being once you graduate? Like, have you thought about that, or is there any kind of like maybe calls to action that you can plant the seeds of here on this call for anybody wanting to help with that growth?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for sharing your story, Chelsea, and for sharing like the racial hierarchies that really do persist despite living in a predominantly POC community, something I really do want to emphasize is that, yeah, like this concept of like the multicultural melting pot is a direct tool and conceptualization to romanticize or disguise a lot of like the racial hierarchies and like socioeconomic inequalities that do heavily persist in Hawaii. I mean, that's seen in like the curriculum that we're learning. We do learn a lot about like Japanese and Chinese migration and labor history, but Filipinos are not included. So many of like our elected officials or people in power in government are either white or East Asian. And like schools still very much are like concentrated by ethnic group. And then like Rick said, there is so much like ethnic humor that perpetuates a lot of stereotypes. So I really appreciate you bringing that up. And we really hope that like culture responsive, critical conscious curriculum is something that can help address that. And as for your question on what we envision the future to be, you know, as we graduate from our programs, I personally really want to return back home to Hawaii and help teach the curriculum. I think that would be such a full circle moment. And I really feel like that is a purpose or a passion that I have in life. I'm so excited to go in a classroom and start off with us with the story of how this curriculum even came to be and the students behind it, the community behind it, and the importance of it. So I really want to be an educator because of this project. And that's not a unique story just to me. There's so many of the students in our project now really want to pursue education because we really see the power in it. And we also really see the way that we can, you know, be empowered ourselves to create that educational space that maybe we might not have had, but we can provide for the next generation of students. I mean, as you can tell, me and Mariah are both studying educational studies. That's something that we will always take with wherever we go. So I'm really grateful for everything this project has given to me. And I really hope that I continue to be able to be someone that can educate and empower students either through like my student voice or eventually my teacher voice.
I just for the sake of time, I do want to get in a few more questions, but I did want to say that it really warms my heart to hear that you want to be an educator. That makes me so happy, because I think that's incredible and the power of these kinds of projects. And yeah, so I'm going to try and combine a few questions together just so we can get an answer to them. This is a combo question from Clarissa and also from John, who are both Youth Action Board members in our New York City Youth Action Board. And so their question is, part one is sort of, how did you go about finding adult co-conspirators / educators to work with in developing your curriculum? And then the second part of that question is, what are ways that we as the Localized History Project and you guys can kind of combine efforts and work together to broaden our reach? And I think this question can also be tagged onto a question for Gabriella, which is just about the role of education more broadly in helping build your own like critical consciousness and awareness of Filipino history. And like your journey in learning your own history. So I'm going to try and mush these together. How can we collectively work together to increase awareness of Filipino history and bring in co-conspirators, be them education, teachers, community members, / books, etc.? That's my mush. So maybe we can hear from Gabby first and then close with the Filipino Curriculum Project.
Okay. Well, I would say that the journey to learn your own history is so difficult when you are not the center of history in your curriculum. So I think that the work that the Filipino Curriculum Project is doing right here is essential. So we should all applaud and support them. But I would say, like, personally, I both reading your own history, and I would say also look specifically for history scholars, not just history scholars, but look for folks who are writing books on your personal history of your motherland that are written by people from there. There are some really, quote, famous books on like the Philippines or U.S.-Philippine relations that are written by some authors that may not have taken the most inclusive or comprehensive look at history and may have whitewashed things. So I would say not just be critical of what you are reading, but be critical of who is writing what you're reading, what they're citing, and always keep that in mind. And then I would also say, again, like be patient with yourself. If you are coming from a legacy of people whose history has been erased, you will not learn all the history in one day, and that is okay. And that is why you lean on your community and why you look to your elders for guidance in their stories.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think that really transitions to the other part of the question of how to collaborate and mobilize with other people of your community, because we really should be leaning on that community aspect, right? And I think the partnerships, the beautiful partnerships and collaborations that we create with educators was because we were able to establish a community with them and create that community awareness that ultimately led to this like inextricable partnership. That's the very like broad general like community nurturing aspect of it. But if I would also like to share kind of like how specifically we did that. I do want to emphasize that as students, because I know we're all students in this call, is that we have so many resources at our fingertips, one of which are the educators that surround us. And so by simply talking to your teachers and talking about, you know, you're passionate about, for example, localized curriculum building, and you really want teacher support, they will be more than happy to give that to you, because as students coming to, you know, the teachers and trusting them and talking to them about something that you are passionate about that has to do with education and student voice, they are more than happy to support you and do whatever it is they can to contribute to that movement. So that is something that a lot of us in the Filipino Curriculum Project have done and have been doing, just communicating with our teachers in general, especially like our social studies teachers, the Filipino teachers that do exist in our school, teachers that can be allies. And that is actually how we have been mobilizing and we have been able to implement the curriculum in a lot of different schools, is because students are the ones talking to their teachers. And it is student voice, it is student demand, it's student mobilization that really is driving this. So I don't think it really has to be a daunting task to collaborate with or involve educators, because they are right there and their job is to support you and they want to support you. You just have to be the one to take initiative, right? So I really, really hope that, you know, this presentation was helpful for all of you, because what all of you are doing is amazing, and we need more students like you and like us to continue to take the reins of our future and our educational future, and know that the community around you and the educators that are nurturing you are there to support you. And all you really have to do is ask.
Amazing. I think that is a beautiful note for us to end on, because we are 5 minutes over. And so I want to honor everyone's time. I do want to shout out that the next localized history event that we will be hosting is with the South Asian American Digital Archive, which is a community grassroots archive of South Asian history throughout the United States. They are also an incredible powerhouse force, like the folks that we've heard from today. Thank you all so much. Thank you to everyone who came. And we look forward to finding more ways to collaborate and do this work together. Bye.